This is the Disability Visibility Podcast with your host, Alice Wong.
Hello, my five-feathered friends. Welcome to the Disability Visibility Podcast. Conversations on disability politics, culture, and media. I'm your host, Alice Wong. Today I speak with Jade Bryant, a Black Deaf writer, producer, and film director. Jade is also the founder of Jade Films and Entertainment, a multimedia company. Jade will talk about growing up deaf and how she became involved in filmmaking. You'll also learn about the Deaf Talent Movement she formed in 2012, which originally centered on Black Deaf Talent and POC Deaf Talent, POC meaning people of color. And by the way, please keep in mind that Jade is the only guest in this episode. She and the ASL interpreter, Jacinta, take turns speaking, or sometimes speak at the same time. Are you ready? Away we go!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Jade, welcome to my podcast today. I am so excited to finally get to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Jade, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Okay, I was born in Jamaica, 1965. And I came to America when I was 5 years old.
Okay, I think I'm going to go ahead and sign, and I'll have Jacinta voice for me.
Okay.
Really, my parents found out that something was wrong with me. Maybe I was about 4 or 5 years old because I wasn't responding. And they thought I was maybe delayed with language. So my parents have 3 brothers and 2 sisters. So there's 6 of us in total.
Brady Bunch.
So we're kind of like the Brady Bunch, you know. And I'm the second to last. My father at the time in Jamaica, he worked as a butcher. And, you know, he had some money. And so he was able to provide for the family. And then when Jamaica ended things with Britain, you know, that's when things started to go downhill for my father. So he started struggling and he decided to bring the family to America. Mm-hmm. So we ended up living in Mount Vernon, New York. So it was difficult. And he would always tell me that the value of a dollar, you know, back then, maybe in the 70s and the 80s, you can stretch that value, that dollar, you know, and become productive. I remember when my father would give me a dollar and I would be upset. Like, I don't have enough money for ice cream, you know, but that's when he would tell me, well, you got to figure out how to stretch that value out. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot from him in that way. Coming to the school system. Now in Jamaica, I was in pre-K. I don't really remember much. Once I moved to America, I went to a school with hearing people as a deaf child. And I remember I used to copy other people's work. And I thought that was learning, you know. And once the teacher told me, that's not learning, that's cheating, Jade. You know, I was like, oh, that threw me off. I had no idea because I couldn't hear. And so I would observe other students. And so I was just copying, you know. I could write, I could read. And, so I think about around the age of 7 or 8, I went ahead and let my dad know that I wasn't doing so well.
Did you sign as a child?
Not at all. I learned that later at 8.
Both my parents work at Lawrence Hospital in Bronxville. My mother was a nurse aide and my father was a custodian. So my father was working in a store that was, a retail store that, you know, wealthy people would go and donate their equipment, things like TVs, radios. So what ended up happening was my dad ended up meeting a wealthy Caucasian man. Maybe he was retired, maybe a doctor or something. And he went ahead and told my dad about a school for the deaf. It's Fanwood, New York School for the Deaf. And my mother went ahead and enrolled me in that school for the deaf at the age of 8. So from there, my world was turned upside down. Well, and not in a bad way, of course, but it was a completely different environment. You know, people were signing, throwing their hands up, and I had no idea what that was. I thought that was far out. I thought that was awesome. I didn't feel like I wanted to stay there, but my mother told me, no, that's exactly where you belong. I don't know how, but, you know, what saved me was a book I was reading. You know, I love to read. And the teacher noticed that and asked me to do a book report based on the book. So I went ahead and did that, and my signing was improving. And so I kind of moved up the ranks and went through different classes until I went to the right one fitting for me. So I love attention, you know, and I feel like I was deprived of this language, this communication. And I was lucky that I had language and I wasn't born deaf. So those two things helped a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of deaf people, finding your community is such a powerful thing to be around other deaf people your age. So like, what was the impact like that on you in terms of probably being alone for a long time without other deaf people around you to communicate with?
Isolated. Yeah, definitely I felt isolated. I remember I would always have my eyes in a book, and I would feel connected with language, with comedy. I remember my first exposure to comedy was Snoopy. So I used to love the comics. And I would walk around with the books, you know, and I wouldn't let them leave my side. So I would notice someone, another student have that book. I would try my best to get my hands on it, you know, and the students would be like, hey, that's mine. But hey, I didn't care at the time. I wanted it.
You're also a filmmaker, and I wanted to ask you, what drew you to filmmaking?
Well, so I was an athlete all my life.
Softball. That was my world.
I played many different sports.
I was playing outside with the boys, mm-hmm. the tomboy, and all. So I was competing with people and competing with myself. No.
So what drew me to filmmaking? I've never had any interest in the arts, specifically drawing, except for playing with my father's camera. Growing up, I remember playing with his camera all the time and his computer at that time, but I never made that connection that I wanted to become a filmmaker until later on in my life. First, I went to Gallaudet University for 2 years, and I wanted to become a PE teacher. I ended up changing my mind because I failed swimming. So,
I mean, I can swim, but I can't tread. Mm. Can't tread in the water. I took drawing at George Washington University. First got a debt, then George Washington University, and I found that I had a hidden talent in drawing. You know, and then I decided to leave got a debt and apply at FIT. Fashion Institute of Technology, and study advertising design, and my associate degree. Then I decided to apply for an NYU. Actually, it discovered me. I was just not satisfied with an associate degree. I said, what am I going to do with this? So I applied at NYU, you know. But when I applied at NYU, I wanted to stick with advertising. But NYU didn't have a degree in advertising, so I decided. But I was not accepted when I first applied because my GPA was not that satisfactory. So what happened was my father decided to speak to NYU athletic director, And I guess he went to bat for me. And somehow they decided to admit me in the program, academic probation, to come back one semester to improve my GPA. And I did. I gave up all partying. I gave up social life. And I got in for a ride.
That's awesome. And you ended up getting a BFA at the NYU Tisch School for the Arts. And I was really curious about what's your experience was like in film school as a deaf person. And, you know, could you talk a little bit about that experience?
Challenging, exciting, because I was the only deaf and black in the program. I remember being put in front of the class where everybody like, criticized my work. I got to do better. You know, everybody watching you. You know, you have to step up. And I remember there was one film that I did was a class where we had to focus on sight and sound. And I was scared, right? Because I don't want to fuck with sound. I said, you have to do it. So I said, okay, fine. So I went ahead. You know, I overcome my fear. Play with sound, experiment with sound. I remember added like music. You know, I wanted to see if I'm able to create, you know. But all of that is a place to experiment. Make mistakes, work together. We all have to take turns. I have to be like the director or the producer or the writer or the camera person or the light. We all take turns. Even sound.
What do you love about filmmaking?
Directing. I love to take control. It gives me inspiration. It's my most happy place when I'm directing. But I also like producing. I like creating. I like seeing an idea become a reality.
People know what a director does. People know what a writer does. But what does a producer do? Because that's also very important.
The producer role that I tend to do is like finding team, the four places, scheduling, finding money, oversee the money, make sure not overspend. I mean, I'm often a set of producer of my content, my film, my documentaries, because, you know, I created them, I made it happen, you know. But then I put the money out, I raised the money myself. I started as a PA. I worked on the film Boomerang with Eddie Murphy. Yeah, Robin Given, that I got hired as a paid intern. I love working on the set so I could see everything, you know, all the action. Seeing Eddie Murphy in action, Halle Berry in action, Robin Given in action, you know.
And can you tell me a little bit about the two essences? I know this is a pilot that you've been trying to get made. So, like, tell me a little bit about the two essences and talking to people in the entertainment industry to, like, get interested in it.
So while I was working on another film, The Shattered Mind, back in 2013, Will Smith announced that he was doing a competition at that time.
For writers.
All writers or content creators.
We had to develop some content based on family.
And it had to have a positive ending. And I went into the contest. So I ended up writing it. I went ahead and submitted the work. And of course, they didn't accept it. But I went ahead and finished the project that I was on. And
I decided to go back to that script of the two essences.
And I made some changes to it. And I had decided to host a stage reading.
It was well done.
And it was feedback. Well done. I got some feedback from it.
put that on hold.
And I ended up putting that project
Shattered
on hold.
Mind. I was busy with the Shattered Mind.
The Shattered Mind film came up. And that took a lot of my time. I ended up winning 16 awards at the film festival. And I toured 47 film festivals.
But Annie booked them
all. But I didn't go to them all 47 of them. But I went to some of them. And after that, I decided to go back to the two essences. I made some more changes. And I decided to raise some money.
$7,000?
With the amount of $11,000. I tried to go for $75,000, but I was unable to do that. I shot some scenes. And what I had was a proof of concept. I tried to search for an agent. I went to Sundance. And I tried to get my voice heard.
I was loud, by the way.
And I was loud, by the way.
What was that like being at Sundance? Or, talking to, studios, various folks, make your case to sell the two essences. How hard is it for you as a Black Deaf filmmaker?
Yeah. After I submitted that Sundance, they rejected it for the eighth time. But that didn't stop me. So I decided to apply for press credential. I had one goal. I would go there and act like I'm covering the Sundance events. But while I'm there, I'm promoting my film. I went to Sundance in 2014. I was promoting The Shadow Mind. But then I won again this year. I remember the first day at the press conference, Sundance asked all the media people to write their question in before the press conference. So I wrote two questions. First question, what would it take to increase POC and Black Deaf talent in front of and behind the camera? And the second question, what will it take for us to have our own TV show? So I submitted online. And then on the day of the press conference, I had my interpreter. I flew her over. I used my iPhone so that I could feed do a live video so that the community can see, because they helped me get me to Sundance, so they need to see what's going on. You know what I mean? And then I said, towards the end, Kim Yutani, she's a new programmer. She drew out my questions. They had a stack of questions, but they only picked out six questions. So mine was picked. She answered the question for media people, press conference. She said, this is a good question because it's unique and it needs to be heard. They knew that I've been trying to get my film out there. They're celebrating the 35th year anniversary, and I asked them, is there ever finding a deaf filmmaker at the festival? In their 35 years, they couldn't answer. So then someone went on their website, they noted that they have a statistic for everything else but disability.
And again, this is something you're familiar with, where, in entertainment, they love to talk about diversity, but deaf and disabled people are not considered part of this broader conversation. Does it piss you off?
Instead of being angry, I got my thoughts heard. So, when Kim Drake picked up my question, then she said, we heard you. And then Sharon Fillow, she'd been at the festival for a long time. She said, I don't know who that question's from. Is Jay here? I said, yeah, over here. Kim said, we've been watching you. We heard you. Someone will want to pick up your contact. Some people want to work with you. How's that? I said, okay, you know. And then he said, keep on creating. Don't ever stop creating. But what's good for me is that I got my voice heard. Mm-hmm. 1 week after sundown, I flew to LA and I pitched my concept.
You know, one thing that I just noticed through following you on Twitter is like how hard you've been advocating for yourself, but just also Black Deaf stories. You know, what are some of the stories about Black Deaf people that haven't been told yet that you want to tell?
The stories that I wanted to tell that's been underrepresented. I mean, I want to show that we can fall in love. We can have conflicts. You know, they always focus on that story about this cochlear implant.
Cochlear implant.
Seek up that story. There's so much other stories to tell, you know, that we can own a store, that we can own a business, we can be doctors, mm-hmm. dentists. Some of us have been raped. Some of us are part of the Me Too movement. Some of us are part of the Black Lives Matter movement. Some of us have been killed by the police
suffered through police brutality.
Yeah. All of that stories to be told. Mm-hmm. And some of us have extra sensory power because we can't hear. So our sight and feeling is compensated for our hearing loss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can be superheroes. You know, we can.
A spidey sense.
Yes.
You know, the typical, you know, deaf representation in film and in TV has been, you know, overwhelmingly white. You know, most people who ever see a deaf character is usually a white person. So, like, within the deaf community, like, whose voices and whose stories are really amplified, and, like, why there's such a you know, just not enough of deaf Black people and deaf people of color to really get their stories out. Can you just give me your own kind of impressions on why that is?
It's a gatekeeping thing. When I go to some of these panels or summits, workshops, what bothers me is that many of them, especially the white industry, if they see me as a Black person, they'll say, oh, but we have switch up both, we have this clothes. I said, oh, can you see what color is my skin? We only share one thing in common, sign language, but you forget a whole other ethnicities, a whole other language. We speak Black.
African American vernacular.
Dance. Let's forget about that. It's because it's not on the screen. That bothers me. I'm tired of that shit.
Mm-hmm.
Tired of that shit. I see a lot of writers or actors, they're gatekeeping us. They feel we're not good enough, but we are good enough. You know, it's time to shame that. Mm-hmm. Only somebody like me can shame that. And I'm able to write that in my sitcom, The True Essence, and others, you know, but The True Essence is about here in the family with two cultures, Black and Hispanic, three languages, sign language, English, and Spanish. But I'm not able to write that. I just get the writer, the deaf writer. You know, she had that flavoring, you know, from her perspective. Thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with me?
What are people that take my forces, like my movements that I've started, or stories that's been overlooked? I'm coming back and take it. Like, for one example, when I started the movement in 2012 to try to raise awareness about the lack of representation of Black Death and especially Black Death towns. And I was going to all these studios, NBC, MTV, CNN. I was standing out in the street with my group and we hold up a sign, you know. It was peaceful. We're just trying to spread awareness, you know. It was part of a campaign movement to spread awareness and raise awareness about what we are trying to do, you know. The representation of Black Death talent and POT in film and television. Mm-hmm. That started in 2012. Then 2015 came, some white people took that and made it all about them. That pissed me off because we've been fighting for our place. And the white deaf people, they were all on screen. Marlon Matlin, Bernard Black, John Morrison, Sean Birdy, Swisha Bells, all these white people. They were all up there. And this deaf white woman, I can't name her, but she took that. So we were trying to do a hashtag, deaf talent of color, Black deaf talent. Then she erased us. She raised the Black. She raised the POC, and she made it Death Talent. Death Talent. That's why I have this hashtag. Hashtag Death Talent So White. To make a point. So all on social media, we were finding who claimed what. Who started the movement first. Everybody know I started that movement. So this white bitch, she took it. And they will all put the center on this white people. If you Google Death Talent, you see white people. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take it back.
Yep. And originally the roots are from you, of Black Death Talent. So that's again another story of appropriation.
It's funny because all these executives, they were all white women. I just walk in with myself, like, hi, but then I start pitching my pattern, and they start asking me personal questions about who am I, if I'm gay, or they're asking about my background, where I'm from. So you white woman, I'm nervous about that. You know why I'm nervous? Because white people have been robbing me from
it. Yeah. She said, I'm nervous because white people have been robbing me.
Yeah, I guess that. That's the story of America, right? Robbing from Black culture.
Yeah, and the three other executives that I met with, they were all Black women, and except for one, she's a biracial, a woman of color. Mm-hmm. But I told this white lady, okay, you got to make sure that the woman of color on my team, on the writing team.
Yep.
I'm not playing.
It cannot be by a white storytellers.
Yeah, and I have to make sure that I oversee it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think creative control is really important for every artist.
I mean, I'm excited, but at the same time, I'm nervous.
Well, it's your life, that's why.
Yeah, my life.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you. It was a good interview.
This podcast is a production of the Disability Visibility Project and all of our community dedicated to creating, sharing, and amplifying disability media and culture. All episodes, including text transcripts, They're available at DisabilityProject.com/podcast. You can also find out more about Jade's work on my website. The audio producer for this episode is Cheryl Green. The introduction by Latif McFound. The music by Winter Sports Team. This is Draft Drop Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Play. You can also support our podcast for $1 a month or more by joining to our Patreon page at patreon.com/DVP. That's patreon.com/DVP. Thanks for listening. Then see you on the internet. Bye!
Rocket to the blast stop, stop, drop, dance off.